Well, I suppose we ought to get started, is that why I say ladies and gentlemen, a little prematurely. My name is Evan Wilson. I am out from Idaho, the center of all things, gentlemanly. It's a pretty cowboy place, so. I want to give you a little background. And I might have to give this to the second session on the ladies. Whence this come, this idea of a word of a gentleman in the way of a lady, it's the title for a little booklet on the subject, Word of a Gentleman in the Way of a Lady. Self-published on my own laser printer and bound by my own foil binder. Years ago, probably in the 70s, I was in a Renaissance history class at university, and I was reading Balthazar Castiglione's Book of the Courtier, or Code of the Courtier. I don't know if have any read or come across Castiglione. The Code of the Courtier. And Castiglione is it, hello, do I got? I don't have anything, but everything else, am I correct about everything? Okay. Did you hear that? Am I correct about everything? So, and if I don't speak up loud enough for you in the back, do remind me. The Book of the Courtier, the Code of the Courtier, was written by Balthazar Castiglione. During the Renaissance, he was a notable, considered at this time, the perfect gentleman. And his book, The Code of the Courtier, is a conversation between gentlemen and ladies of the Italian aristocracy, out of Venice, I think, and a series of nights, evenings, discussions between women and men about what makes a perfect gentleman. It's a great conversation. It's structured kind of like the Decameron or something like that. So I was reading this back in those days, and I think I was drawn to Castiglione because Raphael, the greatest portrait ever done is Raphael's portrait of Castiglione. Mona Lisa is the ugly stepsister at this point. I mean, she's compared to Castiglione's portrait to nothing, but that may have drawn me to, no pun intended, to the book. I was a hippie, okay? Say that up front. And so no one ever told me to be a gentleman. My parents would have maybe in the ministry, and so we were naturally disciplined and the like, but sophistication or gentlemanly behavior was never just politeness or just good manners, that's all. And then when I was a little bit further, either a teacher recommended to me or I ran across a pocket version of something in a used bookstore called The Pocket Chesterfield. And a little book, and I go to used bookstores a lot and look for old book volumes, and I found this old, part of the last century, two centuries ago, book of the sayings of Chesterfield, where someone had collected the best parts. Now, Lord Chesterfield, there's some seats down front, built with there's chairs down here. Then you wouldn't be able to see back there anyway. I am. They were too, and extra points, you guys get A's. So I was reading Chesterfield, and then I don't know if you some of you might know Les Callahan, but Les was going to England, and I said handed him some money to buy me something. And so he bought me the four volumes of Chesterfield's letters from 1776. It was the sixth edition in 1776. They started printing in 1776. Sixth edition. And so the bindings are shot, but, you know, at least it's an old book. So I was able to read the letters entire, not just this pocket collection. And I picked up a few other volumes. You'll find them in the used bookstores on occasion. But Stanhope, Philip Stanhope, Lord Chesterfield, was writing to his illegitimate son on being a gentleman. He did personal letters, portions of them in French, but both Cicignone and Chesterfield viewed the idea not as behavior, but as principle. So they would even easier in Chesterfield than in Cicignone to draw from it something that is completely applicable to you. They would even word it without reference necessarily too deeply to the particular behavior of their time. We tend to, when we teach kids or ourselves, we want to know what to do. And we are happy to tell, don't sit up straight, put your napkin on your lap prior to getting your utensils, all the little rules. And one thing that is, my wife and I teach a class on this at a private school in Moscow once a year. And our basic motto is, and you want to think of this when you're giving students information, one is not what one must pretend to be. Okay? And so all you're doing is creating a bunch of pretentious little prigs that come out of your school with their good citizen badge and right behavior in the times they want to apply it. But you're not making gentlemen, and you're not making ladies. Now, it became more pronounced. I mean, I'd read these things back in the 70s, and I'd been thinking about them. My interest is in philosophy, and so I was thinking about it, and my wife and I have the Big House, which is a boarding house in North Idaho where we've taken students for the last 28 years, and they live with us, and my wife cooks for them, and I argue with them in my library. And generally listen to their weepy noise about their relationship or the lack of one with the opposite sex. And many young men like Nicodemus were coming to me in the night with problems because women, darn them, are difficult. And enough young men were coming to me that in the night, not just the ones that lived at my house, but others, that I was beginning to be called the Oracle. And that oracular status grew, and I had a philosophy student living with me at the time named Jed Suter, so I hope you always give him credit. Fine young man, single and available if you know anybody interested in this sort of young man, who said, we were talking about it one day in the library with Nature, the philosophy of relationships. He said, you ought to go to a seminar. We call it the Mojo Oracles. I said, I'll do it if you get them. So he went out and got a bunch of college students, and I made a notebook and started the formation of this pattern of thought, pulling stuff in from Chesterfield, Cicignone, and various other things. So desperate young men paid me money. My wife fed them through a day, lunch and dinner together and cigars afterwards. And I talked about the philosophy of both relationships and the essential Christian gentleman. Now, after a few years, the women, who don't actually care about men, but got curious that they were getting a seminar and the men were getting one and the girls weren't. So I had to make up rules for the girls and called it the Tao of Eve. So they have the Mojo Oracles for the guys and the Tao of Eve for the girls, and we're putting together 15 rules of gentlemanly philosophy and 15 rules of ladylike philosophy. We're going to look at a few of those a little later in the hour. So, desperation on the young men's part, curiosity on the women's part, which has explained, I think, most of history. Now, this is also not, this is an observation. It is not like suddenly the light fell on me from heaven, made me one of the aristocracy, and in spite of my location in North Idaho, I was raised to this place. I'm from Idaho, for crying out loud. I'm dressed up right now. But it's a study of the philosophy, and we wanted to create a situation where it didn't matter whether you were a Boston Brahmin or a Hottentot or someone who lived in the 1700s or lived in the next century from this, it doesn't matter what the behavior or cultural demands are on you. The philosophy of a lady and a gentleman should serve you in regards to that culture, because it's telling you about an idea, not about behavior. It's, again, too easy to want to just create pretensions. It's easy. People always think that the closest distance between two points is a rule. Now, I call these rules because it sounds cooler, but they're observations, and they're not fixed points, and there is no police action. The gentleman police don't come in and whack your hand with a ruler, and we find that we're all of us at some point in a gradient on all of these rules. But we have to be honest with ourselves about where we are. We're in a discovery process that we are not perhaps as humane as we ought to be. Now, when I say that, I actually mean that. I don't just mean, isn't it nice that we get to study the classics? Isn't it nice that we get to know about Homer and the classical languages? And when we say Hannibal, we know what we're talking about. That's just the difference, you know. So they study new math or whatever it is that public schools are doing these days, and we don't. We're not merely different. We are more humane. And the crisis that egalitarianism has created in our society makes the idea of gentling your condition one that you have to actually overcome a pervading social philosophy that stands like Apollyon astride your way. I mean, it's trying to stop you. Whenever I say, yes, you could be a better human being, there will be people, maybe here right now, who object to the fact that I use the word better. But that's what a gentleman and a lady are. I mean, it's pointless to just say, oh, he's a dentist and he's a gentleman. It's not merely different. A gentleman is a better human being. In many cases, better than all of us men. And a lady is a better human being. Now, it may be battling with your sense of egalitarianism, but when we argue for something, especially in this movement, yeah, I've listened, you know, I've been in this movement since its inception. As you don't know, Doug is my brother. And we don't agree on very much, but he's older, and God has compensated me with being more right. And so we've argued, you know, Wes and Doug and I argued in my library back in 1980 about education, and that's where Logos School started to be hammered out. So I've been around this situation for a long time. And the teaching of Latin, you know, I'm talking right now about a misapologetic. And a misapologetic, I don't even know if that's a word. If I coin something, please credit me. But look it up in the OED and see if it exists. Misapologetic is when people apply the wrong defense for a good thing. And why do we teach Latin in our school? Some parent will come to you and say, and some frightened modern but Christian teacher, well, it's good for their English language skills. It's good. What else is it good for? Better schooler scores on the SAT. Well, says the parent, also sold out for the modern. And the correct apologetic is you look the parent in the eye and you say, well, that's because Latin is better than you are. I'm sorry, but Latin is better than you. So you ought to go bow the knee to Latin for a while. You ought to recognize that it is better than you. But people don't want to say that. We know that we are selling better humanity. And the same is true with manners, and when we're dealing with this idea of ladies and gentlemen. We try to teach manners as a quick band-aid, something that will make the classroom a little nicer. It's really actually pointless, but it does open social doors and keep you from ever finding out about how innately evil your own children and your students are. Mm-hmm. Because, oh, I know, mannered kids, top of the class, get the faculty award. All you have to do is get out to the playground and ask the other kids. They are the demons, the worst of the worst. But, oh, they get the awards, little plaque from your school. All the teachers have been schmoozed correctly. Now, we know that the right apologetic is not that manners are pointless or gentlemen and ladies don't exist actually, but that betterness can occur. You can make, if manners are correctly gained, you can make yourself a better human being. And this is something that has to be in you as well. You have to know where you stand in the great chain of being. If you've read Lewis's Discarded Image or his Preface to Paradise Lost or anything that would include the idea of his sense of hierarchy, you're finding your place in the system. You're finding your dignity. And a teacher should find their dignity and know it not merely by some, well, I'm the teacher, they're not, but are you a lady or are you a gentleman? And do you know it? Do you know what honor is reserved for you? Because when you think about life in this regard, we desperately would like to see dignity and honor come out the other end. We have no idea what how the workings of it are. And so we try to make them. We try to say, okay, every kid call all the teachers sir. That's just a new rule, right? Come out with a rule because Pharisaism is, you know, the best thing. Or dress them up, God help us, in khakis. Part the hair on the side, shove a rod up the butt, because you got to make little, you know, citizens that are either servilely obsequious or false. Now, I don't like what I see coming out of the classical Christian movement, you know, in terms of students. And I taught at Logos for 10 years, and I don't like what I saw coming out of there. We were making little C.S. Lewis's. We were making little poses. Who thought they were better than everybody else, but weren't, actually. So what do we do? We have to understand what's going on. First off, the summation will be the degree to which you successfully govern yourself and circumstance defines your dignity and the honors that are requisite to it. Okay? There's a degree in all things of government to which you successfully govern yourself and the circumstance around you. Stop something from happening, someone who falls apart when something goes wrong, someone who stands up and courageously deals with it. Various people govern their emotions better, their philosophy and mind better, their spirituality better, their finances better. You govern your life because the world is going to hell in a handbasket and it was designed to be futile. And frankly, it will kill us all. Now, your job is to govern yourself and find your masters and understand who are your vassals in this situation. To the degree you successfully govern yourself and circumstance defines your dignity and the honors requisite to it. Now, generally speaking, you are humane to the degree you govern yourself. In other words, a man can have no money. You know, the poor and wise youth is better than the old and foolish king. Okay? He governs himself. And you are wise, it says in Proverbs, you are wise for yourself. And that's the primary point of all wisdom, is not how we pass it on primarily, but as Barfield told Lewis, philosophy is not a subject, it's a way. And you are finding about what way you're going to live your life. Most of this conference, we think about transferring these concepts to other situations, but it's really what kind of person you're being designed to be. So your humanity and the degree you are humane. And there's no moral sin to being less humane. You're just less governed. Okay? And it doesn't, we're not talking economics or whatever, but government of your life successfully is your degree of humanity. We know this when we see somebody completely out of control. We call them inhuman or bestial. their behavior animalistic. As was it in Jude, born only to be caught and killed, creatures of instinct. Well, that's what the world is deciding to live like. They're going to say, okay, fine, whatever my urge is, let's organize that, let's sell that, let's dress it up in clothes, make it look human. But because it is just passion, it's not humane. Humane is government. You're civilized to the degree we are all governed in an ordered society. So a more pronounced order in a social moment is the degree of civilization. So when you look at the period of Louis XIV, the Sun King, and how intricate the society was, it was a very civilized moment. You go from barbarism to civilization on the degree of order pronounced in a society. And the last degree, your nobility, is the degree to which you are of service to it. Okay, when you are governing service to that society, you, that's what makes someone noble. And Scripture enjoins us to take noble to what is, take thought what is noble in the sight of all. We are of service, primarily as Christians, we are of service to our world. Now, on these rules, and what I'm going to be doing is, there's 15 for the gentlemen. This hour is for the gentlemen. I'll let you know what the rules are. Then I'll kind of go through what our general. We try to sum up our philosophy. As first, we have a list, then you have an explanatory sentence under each one, and then there's a short one-page philosophical defense for that. I want to give you kind of a smattering of those rules, because we don't have the time for all of them. Suffice it to say, I, since I'm self-published, this is all that exists in the world. And because they're printed material, more can exist. And we do have them online, so if people want to just get a business card from me and you're interested in ordering them at all, either for your school or self, you can go out and get them, PayPal, etc. But those, if anybody wants one, they're $10. You could pay for this trip. I am moved by, what is the phrase in Ecclesiastes? Bread is for laughter, and wine glad is life. But money answers everything. So $10. Now, the rules, again, I mentioned that they're not actually rules, and the only police is chaos. Some are ethically based. You'll recognize something, that sounds strangely Christian. And you'll say, hey, that fits really well into, you might say, a social philosophy that a Christian should naturally gear themselves to, golden rule issues. Some are going to be inward, how you are inside yourself, your self-government. Some are outward, how you govern the situation. All try to be desire-based, because we had some conversation after the plenary yesterday about all the computer hickiness. Okay? Everyone I was talking to seemed to be suggesting that you go land on your circumstance with some sort of parasitic hobnails and control it, stop it, unplug it, delete it. Again, we naturally run to a rule. I want you, my own children, for whom I'm responsible. I think I'm responsible for all of them. Four, I've worked as one's a lawyer in Manhattan, and one's a jazz singer in Portland, and one's an Army ROTC student, and one's a senior in high school classroom. But they made choices to delete their MySpace accounts because it was lame. Okay? Because my youngest, the high school student, has a cell phone, and he refuses to text anyone because it's lame. And we want to teach our kids an understanding of their universe so that their ordered mind, their control of themselves, that they become better. If that's the behavior of unfettered people, if they begin to be aware that that is less humane, not in the sense of studying humanity, but an inferior human being for whom I must be responsible because they're lower. I have to care for them. I don't despise them. We're not talking about the arrogance of class. We're talking about the service of class. You find out that if you want, oh yeah, you can text if you want. This is how I deal with it. I'll give you an example. What is the hardest thing about soccer? Telling your parents you're dead. About soccer. Telling your parents you're dead. Now, some people like soccer. I do not. It's an inferior sport. Football, the sport played in heaven, is God's gift to sports. Now, you say, I don't know, I don't like this man. You want to start conversations with people that make them defend what they're doing, not just say, in this world, the only thing that exists because we're egalitarian is difference. And what makes your difference better than mine? And I'm saying, no, some differences are better than yours. Some art is better than that. Some people are better than others, and frankly, your behavior isn't. I just wanted you to know, and no, I'm not trying to stop you from doing it. But just realize if you play soccer, you're the queen. If you root for soccer, try to tell me that that's the most played sport in the world. Well, they're inferior nations. Okay? We are the empire, and we watch football. Okay? Now, who really cares? In heaven, God does not sport, maybe. Okay? I'm sorry, I don't make the rules, it's triumph. But you want to let people know that you're dealing with something that makes them go up and down. They're actual up and down in this universe, and they all want to go up. And they all, as they mature, want to divest themselves of those things that hold them back, that make them less. And we have got to admit that there is an up and down. So, today, I want to get you through the... I got to stop at when? When do I have to stop? 10 till? Something like that? Let me read you the list for the guys. Okay? The first rule of a gentleman is a gentleman is modest. Explanatory statement, he will live by his merits, not by their advertisement. Second rule for a gentleman. A gentleman is honest. He admits his demerits frankly. Rule three, a gentleman has good breeding. He is obedient to instruction regarding the artful treatment of others. Rule four, a gentleman has genteel carriage. He practices to display pleasing movements and posture. Rule five, a gentleman is clean. He commits the time necessary to be inoffensive. Six, a gentleman will dress as one. He is obedient to his company. Rule seven, a gentleman has graceful speech. He practices to display his words at their best. Rule eight, a gentleman is observant. He knows that he needs to be an active and informed participant. Rule nine, a gentleman is attentive. He knows that he thereby declares his valuation of the moment. Rule 10, a gentleman is knowledgeable of the world. He has an informed philosophy of mankind that makes his reactions humane. Rule 11, a gentleman chooses good company. He knows his future lies in whom he has opportunity to imitate. Rule 12, a gentleman is not a clown. He has command of his passions. Rule 13, a gentleman has sundry small accomplishments. He has a capable familiarity with tasks considered needful, though small. A gentleman is employed, Rule 14. He is advancing when not in company. And Rule 15, the last, a gentleman understands the dignity of manners. He references the degree to which he has risen. Now, that list, which was initially created as a list going through Stanhope progressively and trying to pull out all the kind of the central main topics that Stanhope always advises on, that he has the most, like, sort of like the fruit of the spirit for gentlemen, you know. And then they say, okay, well, how do I deal with this? A gentleman's employed, where you come up with a sentence that points people in the right direction, and that was not enough, so I came up with short, philosophical, still it's probably too little to write a book about each of these, but short philosophy, one-page thing, structured like this, doesn't have yellow on it, but just my highlighter. Ladies on this side, gentlemen on that side. We encourage our students to read the opposite genders one as well, because something. Although there is no police force, the realization that the girls know what you're up to is a healthy reminder, or know what the standards are, and vice versa. Now, some of these, because you have to realize the gentleman is a social creature. It is not, Jesus loves you, okay? Wants you to know that. Whether or not you're a gentleman. And he will take your benighted soul to heaven on the basis of the death and work of Christ apart from your gentleman's deportment. Okay? And your godliness, the intentions of your heart will be judged by God. And in spite of the fact you might not be an adequate gentleman. Gentleman is a social gift. It's a creature of society that has a separate thing to do. And so some of these things, which I would never tell someone to be a good Christian, you have to have sundry small accomplishments, which I recommend things like learning to shuffle a deck of cards, because someone needs to know. Have you ever been playing poker with a bunch of gentlemen, supposedly? And some guy's over there piling the cards into each other like he was some, you know, neophyte to this. You're going, why am I here smoking cigars with these guys? Someone needs to pick up the deck and fan them together and shuffle them correctly. Someone needs to know how to do certain things. Now, those are the thoughts as I approach these things. I wanted to pick sort of a list of things that where some were seemed inconsequential, and I want you to know why they seem consequential to the social creature. So let's look at Rule 6. A gentleman will dress as one. So if I sound a little unnatural, it's because I'm looking down at the page and there's a certain degree of reading that's going on, and then you'll see these sparks of humanity in me occasionally if I say something. Off the page. So a gentleman who dresses one, he's obedient to his company. That's what we wanted to stress, that aspect. A tuxedo does not make the gentleman. A gentleman is not a peacock intended on flashing the greatest degree of plumage, but is a man who cares to ask himself, what would my company expect and benefit from? If working on a transmission, a gentleman wears coveralls. If the hostess says semi-formal, he will eschew the temptation to prove that he is better than she asks. And since he is in service to others, he will seek to meet each moment with a studied understanding. He must care for each society he enters and not be only on the mark when the moment, be it high or low, calls for that which he enjoys. A blue-collar laborer can in this regard be a gentleman if he studies his obligations to the dress that is higher than that of his normal life, and if he is able to achieve it when called upon. Conversely, if you can't wear the coverall when called upon to do so, as convincingly as you wear the tuxedo, that you are no gentleman, you're an eccentric. That which can honestly claim to be high will be able to accomplish sufficiently all that is below. The word gentleman is the measure of a man in communion with his society. When his clothing does not communicate that he serves his society, it communicates that, if he was conscious of his choice, his effort is to be self-centered, and if unconscious, a mere oddity. Now, in the, because I reference Chesterfield, who is probably Danny Burnley, he has some great stuff. And so I like to include quotes either from the scriptures or from Chesterfield in the book, but this is from Chesterfield that helps perhaps the student along. In the first place, to neglect one's dress is an affront to all the female part of our acquaintance. The women in particular pay an attention to their dress. To neglect yours, therefore, will displease them, as it would be tacitly taxing them with vanity, and declaring that you thought them not worth that respect which everybody else does. And as I have mentioned before, it is the women who stamp a young man's credit in the fashionable world. If you do not make yourself agreeable to the women, you will assuredly lose ground among the men. Dress, as trifling as it may appear to a man of understanding, prepossesses on the first appearance, which is frequently decisive. And indeed, we may form some opinion of a man's sense and character from his dress. Any exceeding of the fashion, any affectation in dress whatever, argues a weakness in understanding, and 9 times out of 10 it will be found so. Now, what's great about Chesterfield, he doesn't tell you what dress, so that he's 1750s, see these letters, 1760s, that period. And he's not telling you how to wear your cravat, or he's not telling you this, that, or the other. He's saying excess in fashion, affectation, which is always the case. We always, you know, we'll throw formal balls or semi-formal dinners at our place, and somebody will either exceed the expectation requested on the invitation. You say semi-formal, they show up in a tuxedo. Since they had it, might as well wear it. Or let me show how much fancier than my company asked me to be. Or people who show up in a Goodwill suit that they bought, hair that was adjusted only by their pillow, and sneakers because they think, I'll just be cool. Well, they've just insulted the hostess of the evening. She asked for X. And when you say, when your children ask for bread, you give them a stone, in this case, yes, that's the stuff. So there is a lot of the aspects of the creature of the gentleman is his communion with his society. What is he about and how does he serve? His nobility is going to be how he serves or rules the society around him. The second thing we're going to look at is Rule 7, graceful speech. Language is the primary link between the minds in a given society. It is the one arena where the symbols pass back and forth have lexically agreed upon meanings. You can sit there, and I'm making barking noises, right? There's barking noises in a closed space, and you're going, because those barking noises vibrate the air of this vacuum between us, that is, intelligence vacuum, and they enter your ears and ciliated cells vibrate at the same frequency that I created, and because we have the same lexically agreed upon meanings to that barking noise, my sentence makes sense. Right? The wonder of language. You can buy a book called a dictionary, which I pronounce dictionary, instead of dictionary, in which these words are listed alphabetically. So that'll help. But errors can still occur. Tone, expression, inference, implication, even malapropisms are among the many ways we can be misheard and cause confusion or offense. The gentleman wishes that he not be inaccurately heard. Chesterfield said, a gentleman will never offend anyone accidentally. Another point says, the gentleman has two modes of expression, either the polite word or the sword. So, pretty narrow, but there you have it. We don't want to be inaccurately heard, presuming, of course, that he wishes to say both what benefits the situation, and is true, he will be alert for the well of the terms, and use it, that his native tongue is granted him. If any man has a gracious soul, it is natural that he, regardless of his education, will normally say gracious things. At least the content of his speech will be gracious at the limits of his vocabulary. That is only a measure of what goes out of a man. A gentleman rises above the presumption that this intent should be sufficient. Well, but they, you know, I'm sorry, but I've said what, I didn't say anything wrong. You know, they measure out their syntax, their grammar, the word, meaning of the word. This is what I meant to say. I learned this early on a ride home from church, where we had guests in the car coming home for dinner, and I would think I was in junior high, and at which point my sister, little sister by 2 years, beset me, as sisters will. And somebody was talking about Heather eventually getting married, and she did, eventually. And I was joking that it would have to be, not knowing what I said, a shotgun marriage. I did not know what that meant, but it sounded funny, and I thought it meant you would have to force her to get married, not force him, because he was pregnant. And my father, who understood the cliche, spoke to me later and let me know what I had suggested about my sister with guests on the phone. Now, I didn't mean anything like that. But because I didn't realize more about my world than just my intention, a gentleman feels responsible for both his lips and the ears that hear him. Okay? Your audience is hearing more than the raw meaning of your words as they appear in the Oxford English Dictionary. For all those ways your composition is being heard, a proper skill to obtain is the phrasing that will make it sing. Choose also your meter, your voice, your gestures, your allusions, which will each decorate what you meant to say with your meaning. Now, we deal with this all the time as educators, in rhetoric and in speech, and because we then even tempted to give them some sort of conciliate-esque form to follow. In there, go get your exordium and your narratio down, and you tell a joke here, make a biblical reference there, and they'll plod through it with that sort of ploddy rhetoric that you get. But if you express somehow to them that the nature of a higher soul, the nature of being better, realizes that if I take responsibility for how I'm being heard, not just what I'm saying, but how I'm being heard, I've got to give them everything that will change the nature of my meaning. If I don't just want to get through this assignment, get through the speech, make sure the words that came out of my mouth were footnoted correctly and the teacher gave me the grade I wanted to receive, because really everything that was being measured was what came out. The gentleman says, no, I need to go to the other end and listen to what is being heard, see how I am speaking. What is the nature of my cadence? Chesterfield himself, in 1753, passed with his work in the House of Lords regarding the Calendar Act, which changed the English calendar to match up with the European calendar. There was an 11-day difference. And so watch that when you're reading historic records from England prior to 1753, because there's an 11-day difference in the calendars between there and the continent. Chesterfield fixed that. He would try to explain the nature of what he was doing to the House of Lords, and if you know anything about the English aristocracy, would have looked far off. They were a dim lot, inbred, who knows how for how long. And he realized that I'm not getting anywhere with these yahoos, and so he just gave a good speech about calendars. He said, he told his son, with well-rounded periods. And the Lords went away thinking they had it explained to them. Because the speech was so good, they thought they understood. And so they voted for his measure. We realize how much of what we're trying to achieve is your meter, your tone, your posture, your movements, your expressions, the fact that you don't know a word that you thought you knew. Inconceivable, I think. How about, we don't have a whole lot of time, I'm just wasting too much on stuff, I guess. We got observant. Attentive, observant. How about good company? A gentleman chooses good company. That's rule 11. Now, because what I first did when I came up with this is I made a poster. You know, there's 11 by 17 poster with the 15 rules and the subheading for each one. Also available on bighouseblues.com. In color, and one for ladies as well. He knows his future lies in whom he has opportunity to imitate. We all know that all the fruit and canned fruit cocktail, this, I don't know, I was handing me, I was inspired. Over canned fruit cocktail, I don't know why it is purchased by other than school cafeterias. It pours out, and they have different colors, little cubes, and they all taste like pear, no matter what color they are. It all tastes like a pear. And you know that's a peach, but it tastes like a pear. And there's a reason for that. It's called marrying of flavors. It sits in the same container for too long. Now, in a more beatific illustration, when cigars are made and rolled to their perfection on the thighs of a large Jamaican woman, they're selected out, I mean, they have a mixture, a recipe, that they follow for a particular tobacco to make a particular cigar. Say they're making the Upman Circle, something like that. They're made to a certain size, vaguely, and a certain recipe, but they're really picked out according to how much they look alike to go into which box. Okay? They want the box, when it is opened by Joe's customer, Kevin Wilson, to look all the same, because they know that presentation is the same. Well, they're pulling cigars made by different rollers and in the shed and putting them all in the same box, and who knows whether they'll taste like. Well, they know. They put them in the box, and they set them up in the great walk-in humidors they have, they know that cigars marry as well over time. You put them in the same box. They take on each other's level of flavor. So it's safe to put the same recipe from a different roller in the same box. If that slight difference will moderate, and I'll get a consistent smoke for 25 cigars because of that. So what's damnable in fruit cocktail is a blessing in cigar. So what we can be is shaped decisively by the friends with which you travel. Now, it is true that you may affect them, but there's a reason why they affect you more. You were not forced into the fruit cocktail osmosis. You made a selection, and the selection of your friends is driven by a certain set of men to whom you wish to belong. You've already decided. You're selecting them because you want to be a frat boy, or a hippie, or a military guy. You just selected your friend. You are leaning approvingly towards the patterns of that group. You want to know what's all on the inside of their speech patterns, their arcana, their special words. Because you want them to smile at you being inside the group, and you have to speak like them and talk like them and think like them and agree with them on a lot of points. C.S. Lewis's essay, The Inner Ring, I hope you have read it. If not, run out, buy it, skip lunch, and read it. The Inner Ring. He bemoans the damage it does to the moral fiber of the individual by adjusting himself to always get more and more entree to this ring of people that he feels excluded from. Now, a gentleman, and oftentimes people mistake what a gentleman ought to be for this inner ring pursuit. We do want to belong, and we do want to move, but the axis along which we move, as gentlemen and ladies, is not from out to in, but from down to up. Okay? Different axis. Now, there's a difference. It's not just, oh, you said down to up. is that just another way of looking at it? Could I turn my head this way, and then that would be in and out, and this would be up and down? No, because in and out is based on inclusion and exclusion. Up and down is based on rules and rules. I have an obligation up and down. Once I admit to up and down, there is someone up above me. It's not merely I want to then gain entree to that level, because I might not be able to. Maybe God, maybe the king, maybe the local governor or count or satrap or whoever is above you. You may never reach that point, but he's still above you. And it's no crime that he's above you, but you owe him service. And you have responsibility down. This is why I think our country likes celebrity rather than nobility. Because I can value someone without thinking they have any effect on my life. They won't butt in. But a noble butts in. If I am your Lord, you do what I say. That's what Christ says, right? Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you do not do that which I say? It's the nature of lordship. And so, gentlemen, is an up and down measure. Oh, it could be used, we've all known people who had power and used it unwisely. But gentlemen exist in that world where they have an obligation, a debt, a connectedness. It's called the great chain of being, the connectedness of all things up and down in the universe. So when I take a place there, I take a responsibility there. I guess our little symbol for the word of a gentleman is this two-headed, violent-looking eagle, and it says noblesse oblige. The obligation is nobility. It's not the lust for fame or the lust for celebrity. It's the obligation of nobility. A lot of times in our ministry, a certain set of gentlemen are developed. We give them a bunch of rules, and a certain clique develops in your school of little freaks, frankly. And you want to belong, that's that cross thing, and they have a bunch of little forms or whatever. They take on the shape, the rules of behavior, but because they're not there in service to their school's real needs and societies, they're not kind and generous, but arrogant and different. They're not gentlemen, they're frauds. And you don't want to join or allow that sort of thing to go on. We have to decide which way we're going to be in terms of what substance we're marrying. If I choose to be with a system and an idea and a set that has a view of society that's up and down, I will be benefited by a growing level of awareness of honor, dignity, things that belong to that world, versus just difference when I run around looking for the best behavior that I can possibly create. Well, I thought I was going to get through more of those than I did, but I kept talking, which took me right to the end of 5 minutes over. Thank you.